I'm Philip Alexiou. The U.S. is warning Iran it should not mistake as weakness President Donald Trump's last-minute decision to not retaliate militarily for Tehran's shoot-down of an unmanned U.S. drone near the Strait of Hormuz. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton said that our military is rebuilt and new and ready to go. He also says threats to international peace and security in the Middle East and around the world are on the rise.
Iran's continued pursuit of nuclear weapons, its threats to exceed the limits set in the failed Iran nuclear deal in the coming days, its continuing buildup of menacing Quds Force capabilities in Syria and Iraq.
The operation...
President Donald Trump says he is delaying a nationwide sweep to deport people living in the U.S. illegally. At the request of Democrats, they have delayed the illegal immigration removal process for 2 weeks to see if the Democrats and the Republicans could get together and work out a solution to the asylum and loophole problems at the southern border. President Trump wrote in a tweet on Saturday afternoon from the presidential retreat in Camp David in Maryland. Well, according to North Korean state media, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un received a personal letter from U.S. President Trump and is contemplating the contents. That's the word of the official Korean Central News Agency, and it's using that as it posted a picture of a pensive Kim holding a letter, apparently with White House letterhead. The agency quoted Kim as praising its excellent content. Now, if you'll recall, earlier this month, President Trump received a beautiful, very personal and very warm letter from the North Korean leader. Though nuclear talks between the U.S. and North officials are stalled, Kim and Trump have been exchanging letters and pictures for the past year. This is VOA News. Well, Ethiopian officials say that the chief of staff of the army was shot and killed by his bodyguard late Saturday, hours after what officials described as an attempted coup in Ethiopia's Amhara state. A spokeswoman for Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said Army Chief Siri Makonnen and a retired general were killed in a coordinated attack in Siri's home. Baleen Seyoum said earlier Saturday what she called a hit squad broke into a meeting in Amhara State Capital, killing Regional President Ambushu McKinnon and one of his senior advisors. Millions of Istanbul residents voted on Sunday in a rerun of a mayoral election that's become a referendum on President Tayyip Erdogan's policies and a test of Turkey's ailing democracy. When the opposition Republican People's Party candidate secured a narrow victory over Erdogan's AK Party in Turkey's largest city, it was a rare electoral defeat for the president in the March vote. But after weeks of AKP appeals, Turkey's High Election Board in May annulled the vote, citing irregularities. British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, former British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, is promising to deliver Brexit in his first formal pitch to the party members in Birmingham in central England. Opening his address, he said, "We need to get Brexit done and be prepared to leave the EU without a withdrawal deal in place."
They're looking for somebody with the determination and the courage and the application to get Brexit over the line, to relaunch our party, and then to take the fight to the socialists. That's what people want.
Johnson's opponent, the current Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt, says he's prepared to do the same thing, but the right way.
Send the right person, and there's a deal to be done. Send that right person, and we can do what we all need to do, which is to come back with something positive for our country.
But for now, Johnson is the runaway favorite of Tory lawmakers to take the party leadership and replace Theresa May as prime minister. Thousands of supporters of LGBT rights marched in the Ukrainian capital Kiev under a heavy police presence. They marched in the center of the capital on June 23rd while waving rainbow and Ukrainian flags as thousands of police and National Guard troops stood by to ensure order. Organizers of the March of Equality said about 8,000 people took part in the event, several Western diplomats also attending the event. Well, that death toll and a deadly building collapse in Cambodia is at least 17 people, 24 injured. The workers were sleeping on the second floor of the seven-story building, which was under construction. 50 to 60 workers used that building for housing. I'm Philip Alexiou, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
And the current situation is environment.com. The federal government, in collaboration with the regional government of the Amhara region, is 100% in control of events. And they have been doing various works and undertaking various tasks to ensure that there's calm and stability within the city, so everything is 100% back in control.
The Ethiopian government says calm has returned to the country following a coup attempt.
What we know is that the participation rate is 60%, and the former chief of the army, Mohamedou Ghazouani, backed by the outgoing president, Mohamedou Abdelaziz, is leading.
Preliminary results show ruling party candidate is ahead in the Mauritanian presidential election.
To call for the same leader, which the opposition claims that he didn't win legitimately, the round table discussion, I think maybe the civil society organizations are missing the point.
And Malawian civil society groups call for dialogue between the government and opposition groups to end the rising political tension. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A spokesperson for Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed says the situation in the country is calm following an attempted coup. The Prime Minister, in a televised address, said his administration foiled a coup attempt masterminded by a high-ranking military official and some members of the military. He also said some people were killed and others wounded during the attempted coup. For more about the situation, I reach Bele Neseyome, spokesperson for the Ethiopian Prime Minister.
The current situation is an environment of calm. The federal government, in collaboration with the regional government of the Amhara region, is 100% in control of events. And they have been doing various works and undertaking various tasks to ensure that there's calm and stability within the city, so everything is 100% back in control.
I also understand there was a coup attempt that the Prime Minister spoke about Saturday. What is the situation and what happened?
So this coup attempt was directed at the regional government, the Amhara regional government in the northern part of Ethiopia. As you understand, we are a federal state. So yesterday there was an orchestrated coup attempt and attack on the executive leadership of the Amhara regional government. It occurred early in the evening. And in that attack, several executive officials were targeted. And unfortunately, we have lost two of them. His Excellency Dr. Ambacho Mokonin, who is the Amhara region president, and also His Excellency Zezuate, who's advisor to the president. And these two have lost their lives. The region's Attorney General, Atun Gbaru Kabede, has also sustained heavy injuries and is currently undergoing treatment in hospital.
Is there currently an investigation going on to find the masterminds, and have there been initial arrests concerning this attempted coup?
Most definitely. It has been identified in terms of who is responsible for this. Someone who had been leading the Amhara region's Peace Security Office head, but who under this administration had been given amnesty as he had been imprisoned in the previous administration. He was given amnesty through the new administration's mercy for political prisoners or prisoners of political conscience. And he had been leading the Amhara region's security office over the past month. So he has been identified as the perpetrator for this, including other people who are working with him together with that. With the investigation, there has been a majority of the culprits, so those perpetrators have been arrested. And there's ongoing operations to bring all of these others who are responsible into custody.
Will the situation be calm ahead of the elections, and what's next?
The situation will definitely remain calm at this point. By the constitution of the regional government, it's the vice president of the region who's currently leading the region, Raga Ayale. So with regards to federal elections, one of the commitments and the priorities of the federal government led by His Excellency Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is to ensure peace and security nationally. So these efforts of maintaining peace and security and the primacy of rule of law are ongoing, have been ongoing, and will be sustained.
Belene Seyome is a spokesperson for Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. She spoke with me from the capital Addis Ababa. Meanwhile, the coup attempt comes in the wake of fast-moving changes in Ethiopia since Abiy Ahmed came to power last year. Horn of Africa regional analyst Rashid Abdi tells VOA Somali Service reporter Harun Maruf that the attempted coup is also going to be a huge setback to preparations for Ethiopian national elections next year.
I think the first thing to say is that the situation is still very unclear. We do not know all the facts. So far, the government has said that there was an attempt to overthrow the government of Amhara region. The attempt was foiled, but in the process, they say that the coup plotters killed the president of Amhara region. There was also another incident in which the army chief was killed in Addis Ababa. And this is, latter, especially the killing in Addis Ababa, was said to also be related because there was a discussion on the, or attempts were being made by the army to intervene. So it could be related, and it could be what the government claims, an isolated coup attempt. But I think there are also suspicions that this is much more broader, and it could be a much more coordinated attempt to actually not just overthrow a local government, but also to overthrow the government of PMRB. And it wouldn't be the first time. The Prime Minister himself has admitted some times back that there was an attempt to overthrow his government.
Was this a surprise, or were there incident signs in the past months that this was going to happen?
I think everyone knew that the situation in Ethiopia was very difficult. And the Prime Minister also claims that he escaped an assassination attempt. So, you know, things were not easy and people were expecting some setbacks along the way. But I think everyone is shocked at the scale of this current unrest, because it actually came from an area which nobody was focusing upon. People thought that if there was going to be a conflict in Ethiopia, a large-scale conflict or an attempt at a coup, it will probably come from the Tigray region and not Amhara. But clearly, I think there is a much more broader unrest, which may have to do with disaffection with either the reform, the pace of the reform, or other issues. But also, I think the most serious and destabilizing crisis which faces Ethiopia today is a very militant form of ethno-nationalism, which has become a big, big driver of conflict all across Ethiopia. And we are seeing multiple conflicts, you know, in southwest, in the west, in the east, among the Somalis and the Oromos, you know, the Guji-Gedeo conflict, the Benishangul-Gumuz. So it is a much more, I think, a bleak picture if you look at, you know, the conflict risks which Ethiopia faces. And I think it is important to also highlight that Ethiopia is an anchor state. It has over 100 million population. And if Ethiopia implodes, you know, there is a large-scale civil unrest, that will definitely have a direct impact on the conflicts in Somalia, in South Sudan, in Sudan itself, where actually the current PM is also engaged in mediating. We will see also renewed hostilities and the end of the peace, you know, accord with Eritrea. So it is going to have a hugely destabilizing impact across the Horn of Africa.
And final question, do you think this incident will affect the process to hold general elections next year, in which some of the opposition parties won it against?
Definitely. I think it is a huge setback to the preparations for the elections. And I think after yesterday's incident, it is probably time for Ethiopia to pause this rapid push to hold an election. I think it is important to hold a good election and not a quick election. You know, he can afford, I think, to delay the election by one more year, in which he gives himself enough time to actually begin a very consensual process, which is very inclusive, which with everyone on board. The risk of rushing into an election in the current context is very real, because it could deepen the divisions and actually even foment violence.
Rashid Abdi is a Horn of Africa regional analyst. He spoke with VOA Somali Service reporter Harun Maruf. Mauritania's main opposition supporters say their candidate Sidi Mohamed Ould Boubacar, a former prime minister, will win Saturday's presidential election in a demonstration last night in the capital, Nouakchott. This, despite initial results showing the ruling party's candidate, Mohamed Ould Ghouzouani, in the lead. Local media reports Ghouzouani, who is backed by outgoing President Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz, are saying Sunday that he would become the next president. Analysts say the election would usher in the country's first handover of power from a democratically elected leader to the next. For more about the election, I read VOA's French to Africa reporter Mohamed Diop in the Mauritanian capital, Nouakchott.
The election went peaceful yesterday morning till the end of the operation. It began from 7 a.m. till 7 p.m. But at night, some protesters from the opposition side hated the police. They were claiming victory of their leader, Biranda Abedrid, and so an activist against slavery.
When did the Electoral Commission say the people of Mauritania will know the result of the elections?
We don't know yet because there are no information to release about from the Electoral Commission. But what we know is that the participation rate is 60%, and the former chief of the army, Mohamed Ould Ghouzouani, backed by the outgoing president, Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz, is leading.
Is he the most popular and his message was well received by voters, or is it because he was also backed by the outgoing president?
He's backed by the outgoing president. That gives him power to be present in everywhere in the country itself.
Tell me about local and foreign observers who came to monitor the elections.
Okay, but just about the most popular himself, we can say that Ghouzouani is backed by Ould Abdelaziz, as I said, and also the former prime minister, Sidi Mohamed Ould Boubacar, is backed by the Islamic Party, the second powerful party in the country, and also Biranda Abed, the activist against slavery. The message of Ghouzouani is to complete what the outgoing president has begun, and the other two, they want to change. And the observers, we can say that they are observers from European Union and African Union. They are also local observers from the civil society and NGOs.
What did they say about how the elections went?
We are expecting the declaration, but till now, there's nothing from them. We are waiting.
This is the most consequential election in Mauritania since, I understand, it will be the first time since a democratically elected president will hand over to his successor. How are Mauritanians taking this as a first step or a major step towards entrenching democracy in Mauritania?
You see, it's very important this time, this election, but as I can say that the opposition, what they are waiting for is to end the rule of the army if they can.
Mildred Oliphant, who recently resigned from the South African Parliament, Mohamed Diop is a VOA French to Africa reporter based in Mauritania. He spoke with me from Nouakchott. Meanwhile, South African parliamentarians, seen as strong allies of former President Jacob Zuma, recently resigned from Parliament. At least 10 parliamentarians from the ruling party, the African National Congress or ANC, have resigned. The resignation is generating controversy after analysts said it appeared the lawmakers quit due to financial reasons. To learn more about the reasons behind the resignations, I reached Mildred Oliphant, who resigned from Parliament and was also Minister for Labour under President Cyril Ramaphosa.
I'm still going to participate in the ANC work. The ANC will decide whether they deploy me, but I think I'll be having some time with my family, particularly my grandchildren.
So what informed your resignation, if I may ask? Because you were not forced out, as some people are speculating, that because you are a Zuma ally, you were pushed out of parliament.
No, I can't say it's because I was a Zuma ally. I was re-elected to serve in parliament. But the challenge was based on the benefits calculation. When you are a member of parliament, you contribute towards your own pension, and then also parliament or government will contribute towards your own pension. And what is happening was that when it comes to benefits, particularly the pension, it is calculated based on your last salary. So both my contribution as well was based on my last salary, and the contribution by the state was based on my last salary. And then when I was seeking the information, I was looking at both my contribution and the state, and I found out that if I'm there as an ordinary member, so I will forfeit almost about 50 to 55% less than what I was going to get right now.
So why was this in place? Because I understand some former lawmakers have called for the administration of parliament to reconsider or review this assessment. Otherwise, it will push good people from serving the country. What are your thoughts?
In fact, of course, that is what is going to happen, because when you look at most of the ministers, deputy ministers, the speakers, when they leave, it's based on that particular benefit. So what happens is that, I think it was in 2011, when there was a decision that they have to remove the issue of dealing with the pension the way it was dealt with previously, because previously they used to have a capping on top of what a benefit should be. So immediately after that, there was a review on that one, and the capping was taken out. So now what is constituting the pension is just the contribution of a member and the state. Capping is no longer there. So the people who benefited a lot are the previous ministers who resigned in 2014 or 2015, because that particular decision was going to be implemented, I think, in 2016.
What do you miss as serving as a Minister of State of South Africa? What do you miss?
I will miss participation, particularly through the leadership, firstly, of the ANC and the leadership of government, including organized labor in particular, because now and again I used to consult with organized labor whenever there are decisions that we have to look at when it comes to the legislation, and also our social partners, business and community at NEDLAC and government. And I want to thank both President Jacob Zuma and President Cyril Ramaphosa for their support, because I have served under their leadership, both of them.
Some of your critics are saying that your administration or the ANC failed the youth of South Africa because of the current high unemployment rate among them, and that they expected you and your government to have come out with effective measures and policies to ensure the youth are employed, you know, so they will not go into the street, you know, committing all kinds of crimes. How do you respond to that?
When you look at the program that is funded by the Unemployment Insurance Fund and the compensation funds in particular, we have looked at the employment equity itself. What was happening is that black people in particular didn't have the requisite skills in certain sectors. For example, when we talked about the inequality when it comes to the transformation when it comes to the SAA in particular, SAA Express and all the airlines, they will say they can't implement employment equity because they don't have black people who qualify to be pilots. And we decided to fund the training of pilots. And as we speak, we have trained about 70 people, young people in particular. And also we have trained young people in scuba diving and cadets
we focused on all those skills that were saying it was needed by the economy, but people didn't have the requisite skill.
Mildred Oliphant, who recently resigned from the South African Parliament, was also Minister for Labour under President Cyril Ramaphosa. She spoke with me from the KwaZulu-Natal province. Some Malawian civil society groups are calling for dialogue between President Arthur Peter Mutharika and the opposition to ease political tension following the recent election dispute. The groups expressed concern that if not resolved, the tension could become violent and plunge the Southern African country into chaos. Their calls came after opposition groups say they would continue nationwide protests to pressure the administration to step down, saying the election was rigged. For analysis, I read Vincent Kondwe, a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi.
My views are twofold. In the first place, the opposition political parties have challenged the process which led to the election of the current president. Therefore, in the views of the opposition political parties, the incumbent president, Peter Mutharika, is an illegitimate president because they are claiming that the votes which elected him were corrupted, were rigged, and therefore his election is not binding on the people of Malawi. Therefore, to call for the same leader, which the opposition claims that he didn't win legitimately to a round table discussion, I think maybe the civil society organizations are missing the point. Secondly, these matters are in courts. I should think that maybe they should wait until the courts come up with the judgment, and then moving forward, if there will still be political instability, that's when maybe the opposition can call on President Peter Mutharika to engage with the opposition moving forward.
Well, some of them are saying in anticipation of a possible political instability, that is why they need to talk, at least to consider power sharing move to ensure the country is stable and there are no incidents of violence that could plunge the country into chaos. You still think that is misplaced?
It is misplaced because it undermines the integrity and the credibility of the state institutions to resolve differences using the courts. The role of the courts is to act as an arbiter in such matters. I don't believe that political settlements in their own are the best way moving forward. Political settlements of such a nature take away the universal suffrage of the citizens to elect the leaders of their choice. However, I understand that where the process is questioned, that right to vote becomes compromised. So in such instances, the courts as a state institution must be allowed to look at the whole process and come up with a judgment other than choosing political settlements.
The High Court ruled recently that the president or the ruling party has a case to answer and rejected President Mutharika's submission that the case challenging his electoral victory should be squashed. Where does this leave Malawians? And do you think the judiciary or the court is independent enough?
It was a big political mistake for President Peter Mutharika and the Malawi Electoral Commission to challenge the petition of the opposition and that it should be dismissed on technicalities. If the Malawi Electoral Commission believes that the leader who was elected in a manner that followed the rules and procedures governing the electoral processes in Malawi, I am of the opinion that the Electoral Commission should allow for the hearing, should allow for the evidence which the opposition claims to have to be tested in a court of law so that we know the truth. Because otherwise, if the NEC is challenging on the petitions, on technicalities, it leaves a lot of suspicions. People would speculate and say, why don't they want the evidence to be brought in court if they believe in the processes that elected Peter Mutharika?
The president also made reference to the fact that he has evidence that the opposition parties want to recruit the Somali-based militant group Al-Shabaab to destabilize the country and forcefully overthrow his administration. What are your thoughts?
That was a very careless political statement coming from the head of state. Why carelessness? Because if the president believes that they have substantial evidence pointing to the serious allegations that he is making, why doesn't the state machinery arrest these opposition operatives who are recruiting and bringing into Malawi the terrorist group Al-Shabaab? Again, when the president was making these allegations, he tactfully avoided mentioning names for fear of legal implications. If the president has intelligence and believes in intelligence which is on his desk, he could have mentioned the opposition political leaders by their names.
Vincent Kondwe is a governance consultant and a member of the Political Science Association of Malawi. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, the World Health Organization, or WHO, says millions of people with epilepsy are reluctant to seek treatment because of the stigma attached to the ailment, leading to the premature death of many. For viewing, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva, where the WHO has released the first global report on epilepsy.
Nearly 50 million people around the world suffer from epilepsy. The World Health Organization reports this neurological disease affects people of all ages and all walks of life. It says this brain disease can cause seizures and sometimes loss of awareness. Program manager in WHO's Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse, Tarun Dua, says people with epilepsy suffer widespread stigma and discrimination as a consequence of their unusual behavior.
So in many settings, people with epilepsy, they are embarrassed. They are not allowed, children are not allowed to go to school. Adults are not allowed to work, sometimes not even marry, or the right to drive is also not there. So these stigma and human right violations, and sometimes also the death that is associated with epilepsy. So premature mortality in epilepsy is 3 times that of general population.
Causes of epilepsy include injury around the time of birth, brain infections from illnesses such as meningitis or encephalitis, and stroke. WHO estimates 25% of cases are preventable. Dua says early death among people with epilepsy in low- and middle-income countries is significantly higher than in wealthy countries. She says the stigma associated with epilepsy is a main factor preventing people from seeking treatment. She says low-cost, effective medication to treat the disease is largely unavailable in poor countries, as are a number of specialists competent to deal with this brain disorder.
For example, if you look in low- and middle-income countries, there is only one neurologist per million population. Now, that's definitely insufficient to provide care for all people with epilepsy. What it means is that we need the non-specialists, the primary care doctors, to take care for people with epilepsy.
Dua says WHO has the tools and evidence-based guidelines that show epilepsy can be successfully treated in primary health care. She says pilot programs introduced in Ghana, Mozambique, Myanmar, and Vietnam are making huge inroads in closing the epilepsy treatment gap. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And delays in obtaining a passport are making some Zimbabweans think of jumping the border to look for jobs and better life. As Columbus Mavunga reports for VOA, from the Zimbabwean capital Harare, people are still applying for the document so they can travel legally. But the wait is long and hopes are growing dim.
Delays in obtaining a passport are making some Zimbabweans think of jumping the border to look for jobs and a better life. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, people are still applying for the documents so they can travel legally. But the wait is long and hopes are getting dim.
It is around midnight outside Harare's only passport office. A line is forming and people cover themselves in blankets or plastic. It's chilly, being winter
in this part of the world. Some start a fire to keep the cold at bay. By 4 a.m. Friday, there are about 20 people in line and they are already worried. Passport office authorities are accepting between 5 and 15 passport applicants a day. The people in line are reluctant to talk at first, but after agreeing on nicknames, they open up, starting with 34-year-old Joe. Joe says he wants a passport because the economy has really collapsed. He says he wants to leave the country because he can't survive in Zimbabwe. He says he will try to live even without a passport. That's called jumping the border because there's nothing he can do because in Zimbabwe, people cannot survive. Highly skilled and semi-skilled Zimbabweans have been leaving the country for decades, moving to nearby South Africa or Botswana or far away to Britain and US in search of greener pastures. Now, even more Zimbabweans want to leave, unable to find jobs in the moribund economy. Last month, officials told Parliament that Zimbabwe's chronic shortage of foreign currency was causing delays in processing passports as there was not enough paper for the travel documents. 43-year-old Mangena fears his 5-year-old daughter will miss the wedding of her grandmother who has resettled in the US. For 3 weeks, he says, he has been coming to apply for an emergency passport in vain. He says he applied for his daughter's passport last year in August. He even offered to pay more for the passport to be treated as an emergency one, one produced in hours or days. Mangena says he has not been lucky for the last 3 weeks. Now, time is fast approaching, and he says he's getting anxious and afraid. They are saying there's no paper to print the passports. He keeps coming to try his luck because he has no one to leave the child with. Everything else is ready for the trip. They just need the passport for his 5-year-old daughter. Early this month, Kane Matema, Zimbabwe's Minister of Home Affairs, said the production of passports would increase because the government had made available more machinery and printing paper. He said printing a few passports a day was going to be a thing of the past. But more than 2 weeks later, the situation is the same, if not worse. That cannot come as good news to Mangena, Joe, and other 280,000 Zimbabweans on the passport waiting list. For them, jumping the border is looking like a better option every day. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with the Africa Cup of Nations in Egypt. The tournament kicked off on Friday with the hosts beating Zimbabwe 1-0. Saturday saw Uganda beat DR Congo 2-0 in Group A. And in Group B, Nigeria beat debutant Burundi 1-0, while Madagascar pulled off a 2-2 draw with Guinea. On Sunday in Group C, powerful Senegal will launch their 2019 Africa Cup of Nations campaign against Tanzania in Cairo without Liverpool star Sadio Mane. The 27-year-old forward is serving a one-match ban after being yellow-carded twice during qualifying for the biennial showcase of African football. Later Sunday, Algeria take on Kenya. And in Group B, Morocco will take on Namibia. In the Women's FIFA World Cup, Cameroon is playing England on Sunday. Cameroon is the only African team left in the tournament after Nigeria lost 3-0 to Germany in the last 16 of the Women's World Cup on Saturday. Also Saturday, Norway beat Australia 4-1 in a shootout in Nice to reach the Women's World Cup quarterfinals. In the other game late on Sunday, hosts France play Brazil. Meanwhile, there are reports that Nigeria threatened a sit-in protest at the hotel over unpaid bonuses and allowances following their Women's World Cup last 16 defeat by Germany. But after hours of deliberation, the Nigerian Football Federation has promised to pay the outstanding fees, some of which date back to 2016. As a result of the meetings, three players missed their flights back to their clubs, which will now be rescheduled. The outstanding money also includes the FIFA participation fee for playing in the tournament. However, according to the Nigerian Football Federation, that fee will only be distributed to players after the conclusion of the Women's World Cup because FIFA is not scheduled to release the money until later in the year. It's reported the Super Falcons have only been paid half the 2 million Nigerian naira, about $4,300, they are owed from previous international fixtures over several years. It's not the first time Nigeria have protested over unpaid bonuses. After winning the Africa Cup of Nations in 2016, the squad staged a public demonstration in Abuja, while in 2004, they sat for 3 days in their hotel after winning the Africa title until allowances were paid. Finally, in tennis, Roger Federer beat Belgium's David Goffin 7-6, 7-2, 6-1 to win a 102nd career title. The Swiss, 20-time Grand Slam champion chasing a 9th Wimbledon title next month, was made to work in earlier rounds but dominated at the final. It's the first time Federer has reached double figures at one tournament, with 8 at the Dubai Open and Wimbledon and 9 at his home event in Basel. Federer had been taken 3 sets by Joe Wilfred Tsonga in the last 16 and Roberto Bautista Agut in the quarterfinals. But after a tight first set, he was handed a break in the first game of the second set when Goffin double-faulted on break point. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now, back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent. You're hearing from Kwame Eugene with Angela, 10 over 10, follows with by Bahati, and then Bakwetu with Papa Wemba. Baby, take my heart, baby, carry go.
Sports. Let's go.
You are my 10 over 10 girl, my number one. You are my 10 over 10 girl, my number one. You are my 10 over 10 girl, over 10, my number one. You are my 10 over 10 girl, over 10, my number one. Hey, you are cooler than them. My girl, you are better than them. Hakuna mwingine kama we, sifa zote mina mpa yawe. You are cooler than them, my guy, you are better than them. Hakuna mwingine kama we, sifa zote mina mpa yawe. Thank you, huyu ndo mbavu yangu. Siri wangu, thank you, saidizi wangu, roho yangu, fungu langu. You are my 10 over 10 girl. Tanga, my number one. You are my 10 over 10, over 10. My number one. You are my 10 over 10, over 10. My number one. I grew up in 10, my 10 number 10. Sit down and like you, baby, I'm not going anywhere. In a touchdown, just to sing about you. I will love you forever. Tanga, my number one. You are my 10 over 10, over 10. My number one. You are my 10 over 10, over 10. My number one. I grew up in 10, my 10 number 10. Sit down and like you, baby, I'm not funny anywhere. In my touch, yeah. Just to sing about you. You are my 10 over 10, girl. My number one. You are my 10 over 10, over 10. My number one. You are my 10 over 10, over 10. My number one.
Tanga.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Madame Agnes Kalama, a rapporteur of the Human Rights Commission, was commissioned to investigate the brutal killing of Mr. Khashoggi, who was brutally killed in the consulate of Saudi Arabia in Turkey. He had obtained an American green card and was an op-ed writer for the Washington Post. He has been very critical of the Saudi Arabian human rights policy. The issue then was for Madame Kalaba to look at the issues, and with limited information available to her, provided by the Turkish government, she produced what has been agreed to be an excellent report, fearless in its judgment. But the purpose of this commentary is to isolate one of her observations. She noted that the Secretary General of the United Nations could on its own launch an investigation about the criminal impact of Khashoggi's killing. Earlier, the Secretary General of the United Nations had said he could not undertake any investigation except he receives authorization from the organs of the organization, such as the Security Council, the General Assembly, and the Human Rights Commission. Madame Kalaba challenged that. She believes the Secretary General could on its own do it now. In fact, she is correct, but the denial from the UN Secretariat is a commentary on the decline of the international civil service since the departure of Secretary General Boutros-Boutros-Ghali. As may be recalled, Boutros-Boutros-Ghali was denied a second term because of the veto of the United States. When the United States Secretary of State was questioned as to why the veto was applied to a man who had done a commendable job, she honestly said that the United Nations would prefer a Secretary General who is more of a secretary than a general. And that is the landmark for the decline of the international service as we used to know it under the great Dag Hammarskjöld. The reason why Madame Kalama was correct is based on the reasoning submitted by Dag Hammarskjöld, the second Secretary General of the United Nations. He drew attention to the fact that Article 99 of the United Nations Charter mandates the Secretary General to bring to the attention of the Security Council situations and issues which are threat to the peace, acts of aggression, and breach of the peace. With his brilliant mind and excellent analysis, he argued that for him to carry out that mandate, he must follow what he called the corollary of Article 99, which means that for him to go to the Security Council on such issues, he needs to examine and investigate disputes, try to mediate, and if he failed, he could then go to the Security Council. This was the argument which was actually acceptable to the majority of the member states. And under it, he was able to send missions abroad. He was able to appoint delegates to countries in dispute. We call it UN presence, and also to conduct independent investigation. So that is what Madam Kalama was referring to. But this secretariat has not been doing it, perhaps because of this deficit in institutional memory of the secretariat. And one could see that in the past few years, the Secretary General's office have not been engaged in political dispute, except, of course, on issues of human rights, where the Human Rights Commission is taking the lead. And this is one reason why it is important to revise the International Civil Service and to make sure that the competent officials we use to advise the Secretary General return. So, Mr. Secretary General, Madam Kalama is correct. Under Article 1999 and its corollary, you can indeed launch an investigation on the criminal killing of Mr. Khashoggi. The question is, does the Secretary General have the political will to do so? I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer for today, Shaogang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a man who takes away another man's freedom is a prisoner of hatred. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm